Today, so that we can dive more deeply into the text, Bruce Brosma will read successive verses from today's gospel throughout the homily. Bruce?
On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine."
Although she isn't named in the Gospel of John, the mother of Jesus is the first person mentioned in this story. Appearing here at the beginning of Jesus' earthly ministry, she appears again at the end, where we see her standing near the cross. Thus, she bookends, or frames, Jesus' ministry in this gospel. Wedding festivities typically lasted 7 days. We don't know which day of seven this was when the mother of Jesus notices that there is no more wine, but whichever day it was, running out of wine could have been viewed as an embarrassing, even shameful, breach of hospitality on the part of the bridegroom. It has been suggested that, at least to some extent, the supply of wine at these festivities was dependent on the gifts of the wedding guests, that it was a BYOW, as in bring your own wine affair. Is it possible that the wine ran out because not enough people brought wine? Is it possible that guests, perhaps including Jesus and his disciples, were too poor to bring wine, thus contributing to the shortage? I would guess that many of us, if not most of us, have been to a wedding. Some weddings and receptions are more memorable than others, not just for what went smoothly, but for what didn't go exactly as planned. A case in point. Robert Fulghum, Unitarian Universalist minister, in his book, It Was on Fire When I Lay Down on It, tells his quintessential wedding tale. The unnamed mother of the bride, hereafter known as the MOTB, wanted everything, every last detail, to be perfect for her daughter's wedding. She orchestrated all the pieces, including the hiring of an 18-piece brass and wind ensemble, as the church organ was too churchy. She called Fulghum weekly. The caterer called him to ask if this was a wedding or an invasion. The day of the wedding finally came. While the guests arrived, and then while the wedding party, with 9 bridesmaids, came down the aisle, the bride was waiting with her father in the church reception hall. In Fulghum's words, she sampled first the little pink and yellow and green mints. Then she picked through the silver bowls of mixed nuts and ate the pecans, followed by a cheese ball or two, some black olives, a handful of glazed almonds, a little sausage with a frilly toothpick stuck in it, a couple of shrimps blanketed in bacon, and a cracker piled with liver pâté. To wash this down, a glass of pink champagne. Her father gave it to her to calm her nerves. She walked down the aisle with a very white face. Just as she walked by her mother, she threw up. That is, she hosed the front of the chancel, hitting 2 bridesmaids, the groom, a ring-bearer, and Fulghum. This was, of course, all caught on tape by 3 video cameras.
And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you."
Note that the mother of Jesus doesn't tell the bridegroom or the steward about the lack of wine. She tells Jesus. Does Jesus' use of woman in speaking to his mother seem harsh and impersonal to you? Biblical scholar Raymond Brown suggests, however, that it is not a rebuke, nor an impolite term, nor an indication of a lack of affection, but rather that it is Jesus' normal, polite way of addressing women. From the cross, Jesus uses the same word to address his mother when he sees her and the beloved disciple standing together. "Woman," he says, "here is your son." Then he says to the disciple, "Here is your mother." And from that hour, the disciple takes her into his own home. And there's that word "hour" again. We note here that in John's gospel, "hour" refers to Jesus' glorification, which is Jesus' passion, death, and resurrection. So even though Jesus appears to distance himself from becoming involved, the mother of Jesus seems to have no doubt that Jesus will intervene, though she doesn't try to control how. And did you catch that? She believes in the effectiveness of Jesus' words even before they are spoken. Serving as a catalyst for what will happen next, she connects the servants with Jesus to carry out his instructions. Thus, she expands the circle of caring. In this regard, a commentator noted, "I wonder whether the wine giving out could be a metaphor for the life and joy going out of our lives, our churches. Who will notice? Who will advocate? Sometimes we will be in need of someone who notices something wrong. Sometimes we will be the one to go to Jesus on behalf of someone else." This story shows a community, the wedding gathering, that relies on the person who notices and acts.
Now, standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said, "Fill the jars with water."
Six jars, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. That comes out to between 120 and 180 gallons of water. How far, I wonder, did the servants have to go to get the clean water? Were there lots of servants to carry this water? Or did just a few have to make many trips? Have you ever needed to carry a bucket of water from a well? Or out of a basement, perhaps? For many years at the New England Synod Assembly, Doreen Reines and Pastor David Reines have prepared displays and led workshops on behalf of ELCA World Hunger to illustrate the time and effort involved in obtaining clean water in some countries. They have filled 2 5-gallon water jugs and then asked volunteers to lift them and imagine carrying them while walking the average of 3.7 miles needed to get daily household water. And just for the record, 5 gallons of water weigh about 40 pounds. But it isn't just in African countries where access to clean water isn't readily available to everyone. Consider, for example, the case of Flint, Michigan, with its toxic lead-infused water. I read an article recently that quoted a man as saying, "I won't live as long or as well because I drank this water." April of 2018 marked the end of a free bottled water program in Flint. However, as of this fall at least, many people were still only drinking bottled water. Churches took notice and took action, working to distribute bottled water to as many people as they could while their supplies lasted.
And they filled them up to the brim.
The servants don't just fill the jars, they fill them to the brim. But our jars are not always filled with cool, clear, clean water. Michelle DeRuscia, writing in the January issue of Living Lutheran, notes, "We fill our days to the brim with busyness, checking items off our to-do list, running endless errands, cramming our calendars with social events. Thus, we avoid the silence, stillness, and solitude necessary for self-reflection. If we're not accustomed to taking regular times for stillness and silence," she suggests, "try sitting for 5 minutes each day this month in a quiet, comfortable place, away from the distractions of your phone, your to-do list, and your loved ones." At other times, our jars are not filled at all. They may even be, at times, nearly or completely empty. Expressing this concern in the U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday, January 9th, recently sworn-in Massachusetts Representative Ayanna Pressley said, "So today I rise to lift the voices of the unheard. I rise today on behalf of the families concerned about feeding their children because their WIC benefits will run dry. I rise today in solidarity with the thousands of workers with calloused hands and broken spirits working for no pay. Today I rise as one, and I stand as thousands."
Jesus said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now."
So Jesus does respond and gives orders to the servants to act. Jesus, the invited guest, becomes the host who provides wine. And what wine it is! This is not a grand public gesture with trumpets blaring and whistles blowing. Not even the bridegroom or the steward knows where this good wine comes from. but the servants, those on the margins, those perhaps invisible workers, they know. In Fulghum's wedding story, after her daughter's disgorging, the MOTB fainted. Yet, life flowed out from the confusion. Guests went to the reception hall for the interim, and, in Fulghum's words, the bride was consoled, cleaned up, fitted out with a bridesmaid's dress, and hugged and kissed a lot by the revived groom, who held her in his arms through the entire ceremony.
Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
This is the first of the signs in this gospel. John, by the way, does not call them miracles. What is the purpose of a sign? To point to something, to give directions or instructions. One definition of sign is an object, quality, or event whose presence or occurrence indicates the probable presence or occurrence of something else. Thus, the water becoming wine isn't the stopping point. Rather, it points to something, or in this case, to someone. The disciples, who by this point also must have learned the source of the good and abundant wine, the disciples have seen Jesus' glory revealed and now believe. Believing or coming to believe is important to this gospel writer. There are 84 occurrences of believe or believes or believed. Near the end of the gospel, John states the purpose of the book. Jesus performed many other signs as well, signs not recorded here in the presence of the disciples. But these have been recorded to help you believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the only begotten, so that by believing you may have life in Jesus' name. How appropriate that this first sign of Jesus is performed at a wedding celebration. Jesus manifests God's glory here, not in the presence of principalities and powers, but in the presence of family and friends. God's nearness, God's mingling, as it were, is here in this intimate setting. This is where scarcity is turned into abundance. As Pastor Luke L. Bowman notes, the gospel text is not only a story about Jesus as Messiah, it is also about what kind of Messiah. God's gracious participation in our world as a serving presence sets the table for our understanding the cross and resurrection as revealing the very heart and mind of God. God will enliven and enrich the world as God intimately connects with humanity. Wine flows out of the jars in spite of the water within. Life flows out from the empty tomb despite the power of death. Where we create scarcity, where we manufacture a dull existence for ourselves, God gives life and pizzazz in abundance. The prophets, Amos, Hosea, and Jeremiah, all speak of an abundance of wine as a symbol for the joy that is to come. Speaking of joy reminds me, that infamous MOTB. Well, on the wedding couple's 10th anniversary, a party was held. A feast was laid, best friends were invited, and all the films were shown on 3 different TV screens. Who organized this party? None other than that infamous MOTB. Having forgiven everyone, including herself, for their parts in the unforgettable wedding, it was the MOTB who laughed harder than anyone else. There was an abundance of love, joy, and grace at that couple's wedding. I like to think that Jesus was invited to be present as a guest at the wedding and at their anniversary feast. For Jesus came that we may have life and have it abundantly. Whether we choose to drink wine, whether we choose not to, or whether we cannot or should not drink wine, let us find our own abundant symbols of joy. Not necessarily in something grand and showy, but perhaps in those precious moments with friends and or family, but also, and equally importantly, in those times for personal meditation, stillness, and silence. And may we try to imagine joy, believe in joy, and act on joy. Let us try to imagine something that is so satisfying, so delicious, and at the same time so abundant that we have to share it with others. Then let us believe that this grace-filled abundance is God's gift to everyone, even to those whom we deem to be undeserving or whom we don't like very much. And then let us find our way to act, either as individuals or as part of the community, to manifest God's presence to the world. And may it be so.